Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what the fuck stirs? How's it going? Are you okay? Is everything all right? Did you get over it? Did you get it checked? Are you feeling better? Are you getting out much? How terrified are you? Are you in the midst of an existential tailspin? Where are we at? What's going on? Put the ice cream down. Put it down. It's 10 a.m. Enough with the cookies. It's 7 in the morning. That's not breakfast. So today on the show, this guy, Drew Michael, he's a comedian, a writer. He was a staff writer on Saturday Night Live for a couple seasons. Back in 2018, he did an experimental self-titled comedy special where he had no audience. His new special is called Red, Blue, Green. Look, I didn't know this guy. And my old manager represents him. And my old manager said, do you know this guy? And I'm like, I don't know this guy. And he said, he's got this special, Red, Blue, Green. And I said, all right, well, I'll check him out. But I don't. But that's just the way this goes sometimes. I don't know all the new comics, the young guns. But I watched this guy and, you know, his groove was familiar because there's only a few guys that do that. At any one time, I used to be one of the guys that did that. Maybe I still am. There's a type of comedy, a type of tone that I think I was a little more aggressive about when I was younger. I can see what you can't see tone. I watched this guy and, you know, I saw something familiar, something I related to. And I thought, okay, I'll talk to this guy. So he's here today. And we had some issues. And I'll get into that in a second. So I talked to you about Buster. Yeah, Buster's still on. He's good. Bounce back. Thank God. I gotta quit leaning on the cats. Do you know what I mean? I got to just give him a rest. Hyper-focused. There's a lot going on, though. It's very awful that Saget passed away. And as most of you know, I posted the... just all the talks we had. We had three, and he was so funny and so nice and so just a great guy. It's very sad. And I'm going to go to the funeral, and I generally don't go to funerals. I don't know why I don't. I mean, funerals are definitely different than weddings. You know, they only happen once, and it's heavy. But I mean, I didn't go to Patrice's. I didn't go to Geraldo's. I really haven't been to a funeral in a while. Because I'm either not around or I'm on the road. But I'm going to Saget's because I'm in town. It's not far. And I have a suit. I have a black suit. As an adult in show business, you have a black suit. That's my choice. I don't have a tux. I have a black suit. So that's either apparently for award shows where I don't win anything. And now for funerals. That's why I have the black suit. You can go to a lot of award shows in your black suit and never win anything. And you can go to funerals in your black suit and at least... know that that's what you're going to get. That's definite. The award, who knows? Death, it's coming, baby. But I don't know his family at all, but I know his friends, and we have friends in common. And I'm going just to, you know, as a show of respect and love for the guy. And his first funeral I've gone to in a while. And I don't know. I guess I have an aversion. Who doesn't? But I got to grow the fuck up. It's time. You know, go show up for the other people. I'm very sad that, you know, when Lynn died, I don't know. I guess there was a memorial up in Seattle with her friends during COVID, but there was nothing here. I was not involved in anything as a memorial or a funeral or anything like that for Lynn. And, you know, I regret that. I think that, you know, you do get closure. There is something about processing the passing of somebody and processing grief in general that happens when you go to a funeral, when you sit Shiva, when you go through the process of sort of collective grieving. But, you know, I got a black suit. I'm going to wear it. So this guy, Drew Michael, this comedian. So what happened? I'll tell you what happened. So as I said earlier, my old manager, Dave, you know, suggests this guy to me. He says, yeah, have you checked him out? I'm like, no. He says, yeah, you should check him out. I think you'll like it. And I want to see if you'd be interested in having him on. So I'll check it out. And this guy did something. He's different, obviously, than me. And there's a type of comedy that is the practitioners of which are far and few. There's only a few. And I know where it starts. I know where it comes from. You know, I know the sources. You know, there's Hicks, there's Stanhope, there's whatever I was doing when I was younger, maybe a couple of other people. But I just know where the guy was coming from. I could tell by the style and how he was, you know, trying to prove what he was trying to prove. The sort of lesson teaching of the tone. And I watched it, and you know, there's a couple of great bits in there, and there's, you know, the ending's interesting. But I just felt there's some stuff in it that was familiar to me, and I got a little squirrely about it, and so I did some Googling, and I found some stuff that made me uncomfortable, and I told Dave, and he told this guy Drew, and Drew was like, I'll talk to him about it. So, you know, there is some stuff. There is some discussion of either parallel thinking or not knowing something has been retread. I stopped short of like calling Stanhope to say like, wait, do you know this guy? Have you watched this? Am I wrong? Is there something? Is this? Yeah. But it doesn't matter really. You know, I was diplomatic about it, and the special ends well. And as I said, there's some good bits in it, but it just, I don't know if it was because it sounded familiar to me because of what I used to do or what I do, or, you know, whether or not, you know, it's just, he's the new guy doing it. Who knows? But we get into it a bit, and he's a very smart guy. The special is called Drew Michael, Red, Blue, Green. It's now streaming on HBO Max, and this is me talking to Drew. Well, that was the thing about people coming to the house, was that it was disarming, you know, because it wasn't, when I started this thing, people weren't used to doing that, right? So they'd come and they'd have to reckon with the fact that, you know, not only was it like some studio, but it was my life.
Yeah, so that's what I'm saying. Like, you know, you're cooking a soup or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So like, it brings people to a different place,
right?
You know, right away, it's a little, gets them off center, you know. It wasn't on purpose.
Just like pulling up into somebody's home.
Yeah.
It's a, I don't want to say intimidating experience, but there's something to it. It's definitely uneven.
Right. It's not show business. And it's like, you don't know really what you're getting into. Like if you go to a TV studio, like you did Kimmel the other night, you kind of know you're going to go to the dressing room. There's going to be some snacks.
Yeah.
Someone's going to talk to you about the thing.
Right.
But when you're just driving to a guy's house, it's sort of like, I don't know what's going to.
Well, I didn't even know that there's no one else here. Like,
no.
There's no one running.
No. No one's here.
No one's running the mics. No one's running the soundboard.
No.
It's just
you. Just me.
Yeah.
It becomes an issue when people bring people. That was my whole big idea, was like, I'd get this separate building and people could, you know, use the bathroom out here. And if they brought people, they could sit in that other room. But I don't like it. I make them sit outside.
Yeah, I kind of knew to come solo.
Yeah,
I was like, I don't think this is like a bring people. This isn't a plus one affair.
You're going to bring Becky.
Yeah, no. I think my brother wanted to go. My brother came to Kimmel with me, and I was like, I think this is just going to be me.
Does he live out here?
He does, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's he do out here?
He works for he works in sales.
Oh, he's just out here.
He's just out here. He and his girlfriend moved out here.
Huh.
To get away. They were from Chicago.
Yeah.
They wanted to get out of the weather.
Yeah.
And it was either New York or LA. They decided to come here.
Well, New York wouldn't get you too far out of the weather.
Yeah. No. It. I mean, whatever. It's all over.
Well, yeah, yeah, that's it. Well, that's the interesting thing. Like, it is. I agree with you. People are garbage and the earth is dying.
Well, it's just like, every turn, it's just like you forget about it for a second. Like, you can have like those moments of solace with yourself.
Yeah.
And then, you know, even just at the airport.
Yeah.
Everyone's in a mask, which I'm for.
Sure.
Like on a germ level, on a people are gross level, like cover your face.
Sure.
But it's a harbinger. It's like it's an omen. It doesn't look good.
It's not an omen. It's here.
Yeah, it's an omen for a second from now.
It's not a sign.
Yeah.
This is how it's going to be.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but it was weird. You know, like I watch you, and then like I'm like, yeah, you know, I know this. Like there's because you do what I do, kind of. You know, not in a bad way. You know, there's only a couple of guys that talk about themselves that thoroughly and think about the world that, you know, sort of engaged and angrily and cynically. I just related to where you were coming from.
Sure.
Because I can see how you built yourself.
Yeah.
Comedically.
I'm sure you can see that. The way I would put it is like if we were videos at Blockbuster, we'd be on the same wall.
Yeah. Yeah. The one that no one rents. the wow. Weird, you know, small cult wall of aggravated Jew comics.
Jeff's picks.
Jeff the angry guy, the brooding guy.
Do you feel yourself getting territorial when someone comes along and either echoes some of the same themes or same impetus for what you're doing, you know, because obviously you've been around longer than I have, and I can relate to that. I mean, I'm not, you know, I haven't been around as long, but I've been around long enough for another generation to exist
right
underneath me, quote unquote, in the chronological sense. And so I think I can relate to the feeling of feeling like
threatened?
If someone's encroaching territory, a little threatened,
not so much
that
because
better or worse. It's just
The thing is that there's only like a handful of people that do what we do at any given time. You know, there's not a lot of people doing, you know, relatively progressive, cynical cultural commentary. It just isn't.
Right.
And there aren't that many people whose heroes might be Hicks or Stanhope or, you know, whoever, you know, Louis, whoever, you know, moves you in that direction towards sort of an angry revelation type of comedy that isn't, at this point, there seems to be a lot of that going on in a kind of hackneyed sense in the anti-woke crowd.
Right.
But that's different. You know, they're taking it a different direction, and it's not really humanistic, even in a sort of a Hicksian misanthropic way.
They seem to be taking some of the worst parts of the people we're talking about without the weighted humanity, without the, you know, levity, without like the thing that makes it what it is. It's like those types of comics that you're talking about, you know, the ones that inspired, you know, people like me and also the other kinds of people you're talking about. I think, you know, what they generated a kind of backlash that has now, it's kind of been like reverse engineered, like where people are looking at the linchpin of those comics is like they generated this kind of uproar. And so people, I feel like, are seeking the uproar as a way to essentially validate themselves as that type of comic.
Well, that's interesting. But like ultimately, historically, what I think is that, you know, those guys are, you know, and, you know, Doug is still alive. And yeah, I think he's the only true proprietor of that envelope pushing business. But, you know, no one, Hicks is a comic phenomenon. He's a myth among us. Mm-hmm. You know, he generated very little uproar. He, you know, he had a hard time making a buck in this country.
Yeah, sure. So, but, you know, getting cut from Letterman and the religious right backlash.
Yeah, but that was still very,
was like a real
very
thing.
Small.
Sure,
was, you know,
sure.
Relatively speaking.
Sure.
But I think what you're doing, what you're saying is probably true in that the drive shaft of you know, fuck you-ness has been co-opted and misdirected.
Well, yeah. I mean, even on the small scale, I mean, it doesn't matter when you're watching a Hicks clip on YouTube and you see the crowd turning against him and you see him saying, you know, Hitler had the right idea. He was just an underachiever.
Yeah.
You see that kind of acrimony existing between the audience. And the fact that he was overlooked makes people say, okay, so if I'm also neglected by the mainstream,
I must
that's
be
like,
doing amazing.
Yeah, it's a badge of honor.
Right. It's a badge of honor.
It's a marketing tool.
Right, but now, and we're getting into the weeds, I just feel that, you know, anti-woke anger is the new hack, and a lot of unfunny people can cop the disposition and then blame their lack of ability to get work on the fact that they're just too, you know.
But it's all promotional.
I get that, but it's only going to work with a small bunch of people. Yeah, it's promotional, but I mean, there's a bunch of secondary anti-woke dudes that are not going to get work unless they're touring with the primary anti-woke dudes. So you're saying it's a grift.
Well, I'm saying that it serves a purpose, and it seems to be fueled by almost nihilism. Like, there is no belief at stake here. There's no principle.
I think that nihilism is being exploited by somewhat fascistic forces to do its bidding. And I mean, that's the problem, is when you see guys you've known for 20 years lock into this mindset around language that is just operating to sort of fuel the fire of wrong-minded bullshit on a tribal level. And what, you know, what they're calling their fans is really just this army of fucking meatheads that aren't really comedy people.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, if people are, you know, a ticket is a ticket in some people's minds. Like, I'm not saying that, but like, to me, and this is, maybe this is the weeds, I don't know, but like, after Trump, it's kind of just like, okay, so having a lot of people support you or follow you is meaningless.
But
it doesn't mean that you're saying anything good or right or correct.
No, it just means you can get through to them and they'll give you money and you satisfy some, you know, broken part of their fucked upness and elevate it.
Yeah, you're speaking to them on an emotional level without it being emotionally complex.
You're validating a
part of them.
But the thing that is concerning is that, you know, I've been doing this bit on stage about you know, I'm not one of these comics that you'll ever hear say, like, right, fellas? Because I don't even know what you guys do. I'm not you guys. Who the fuck, you know, hears right, fellas and goes, yeah, that's me. You know, you're doing something wrong, right?
Right.
So, like, because me, like, I don't identify with hardly anybody. I get, you know, I can get things, you know, in common with some people, but I've sort of, like, fought to have my own self.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what you're supposed to do, right? To actually be a free thinker. So if we got into this racket, you know, to sort of get our thoughts, which I think is what you do. You do that, and that's why I did it. I didn't get into this because I felt like I was an entertainer.
Right.
I got into this because I thought it was a reasonable place for me to find myself and to figure out what the fuck my truth is and how to be seen.
Yes, yeah. Stand-up was a language that I kind of just implicitly understood. You know, I watched stand-up and I was like, I think like this. You know, like, this is kind of how my brain works. I didn't know this was anything. I thought this was just like weird, isolating rumination.
Yeah.
I didn't think that this had an outlet. And so there was something super liberating about, you know, seeing people that spoke to me in that sense and saying, okay, this is a place where I can, like you're saying, iron out, you know, some of my own.
You can
own
choose your own territory.
Inner identity.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And if I started to feel like I was being, you know, embraced by like, you know, a
group.
Clan. Yeah.
It
always feels a little uncomfortable.
Well, yeah, because that's something different, and it you know, you attract what you are. So I imagine just from watching your stand up, and look, I identify with where you're coming from, in terms of having, you know, selfish parents, philandering father, that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, I mean, I had that, but I mean, I didn't have the hearing thing, but we can get into that. But like that, my point was like that there's some sort of tribalization going on. And that right now there seems to be a fine line between, you know, mainstream, you know, comedy shows and rallies. What I always got into it for was to sort of have a small audience, work the shit out and have a revelation each show, you know, for myself and for other people and to get somewhere.
Yeah, or even, you know, in between the shows where
sure.
You do the bit, you do the set, and then you're thinking. Sometimes I can, you know, think most clearly about the act or about the bit, about the material when I've just done a version of it because it's fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
I'm able to replay it in my head almost like, you know, sitting in the back
sure.
of the room of my own show.
Yeah.
And so you're kind of fresh and the adrenaline's kicking and you're kind of walking around after the set thinking about
it.
What and
sticks?
A lot of times, the clarity comes in there where, you know, there's something that you add, there's something that changes or shifts.
But
like you say, when you're talking about personal things, even if it's not literally personal, it's not literally about your life, you know, these things are close to you, those revelations that you have comedically can also be, you know, a personal revelation.
Well,
like,
always,
this is what I think, or this is how I feel.
Sure, you don't
this.
Know how you think until you say it, and then, like, you don't know where it's going to go until it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But I just know that from what you're doing up there, you're not looking for, you know, mainstream success. And, you know, sadly, you know, I'm further down the line than you.
Sure.
You know, with, you know, some of the things you're wrestling with. And, you know, not everybody's like us. So that's going to be the weird kind of, you know, crossroads. It's sort of like you have to accept the fact that people are laughing because they're like, what the fuck is this?
Sure.
And then you're going to have to accept the fact that, you know, how different we are. And then you start to accept the fact that, like, I'm sharing these emotional handicaps in an effort to, you know, figure out who I am, but also in an effort to be seen by like-minded people. And I continue to do that. But, like, there's nothing simple about what you're doing.
Right.
Or what I'm doing. And you've decided that.
Well, do you also, so something that I've been wrestling with recently is I think I used to be much more gung-ho about the idea that I was working it out both personally and professionally in the same forum. And something that I've come to, you know, I'm 36, and so that's, you know, that's not old.
Right.
But it is the first time I've ever felt not young.
Yeah.
You know, like,
sure.
I'm not the young guy. Like,
right.
There's other people around. Who like, I don't know who the fuck you guys are, or what you do.
Yeah.
Like, I go to the Lower East Side in New York, you know, especially after the pandemic, because, like, I'm 2 years older, but the Lower East Side is still 22.
Yeah.
So, like, it's...
They all got money.
Yeah, I don't know what they... I have literally no idea what these people are operating
right.
on.
Right,
So there is, like, that is the first time I've ever experienced that, where there's a legitimate generation that isn't high school kids.
Yeah.
That's like, I don't know.
I get what you're saying. Like, oh, look, I'm a real grown up.
Yeah, they're like doing stuff.
There's fresh grown ups that are younger
than me.
In
my way, but they don't know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, you know, at this age, I've started to, you know, obviously reflect on that and question that. And I start to look at the people, and I talk about this in the special. Like, I talk about the people that I looked up to, and I see kind of like, you know, comedy's a pretty small world. You either get to know them on some level, or you're around them, or you have access to, like, their offstage happenings, whatever. And some of it's national news.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I look at, like, where the people have ended up life-wise, and I'm like, okay, so super inspiring on stage, but, like, maybe not so inspiring off stage. And I question how connected those two things are.
For yourself?
Or generally, like, how much are we locking ourselves into a modality that prevents a certain type of actual growth, because we can always, if we need to, mine it and articulate it beautifully and all that stuff for something that can be lauded and something that can be applauded.
But you know, but not necessarily, like, it's a risk, you know, with somebody like you or me that, like, you don't know. I mean, like, you seem to be doing okay right now. We'll see how it all lands, right?
Sure.
But depending on who you are, how you handle it, it will become a shtick, or it won't if you don't let it. And it seems that you're compelled to go beyond that. Like, I watched a special, and, you know, I have, you know, very specific opinions of it because you and I are, you know, coming from the same wheelhouse in a way. You know, I paid a different type of attention to it because I could sense. And to answer your question is, I don't find it threatening, but to finish the thought from earlier, I know there's only a few of us that do this. And so when I see somebody doing it, I'm like, there's a part of me that's sort of like, oh, what the fuck is this? But then I realize, like, it's not the easy path, and there's not that many people that do it. So, you know, just hear them out. But it is funny, the comparisons of, because, like, I know when I'm paying homage to certain things that I've taken in as I've gotten, you know, through this life. Mm-hmm. Like, I know in the last special that I did, End Times Fun, that my, you know, giant closer, you know, where Mike Pence blows Jesus, that, you know, that really isn't my particular style right now, but it is a tip of the hat to Hicks. I know that structurally, and I do come from that, and I did do that at some point, but I'm highly aware of it.
Sure.
Like, I know when I'm watching you that, you know, when you talk about Fallon the way you do, that, you know, I watched, you know, we all talked about Leno. Hicks did a fairly extensive bit on Leno that was even more brutal than yours, but the same criticism of the same job by a different guy.
Similar criticism. Yeah. I mean, but it's definitely, that's a conscious homage.
For sure.
Where it was something I riffed, you know, I think I was in D.C., and it was just kind of like a fun... Like, I never do voices or impressions of any kind. It was kind of just fun.
When you do it once, right? And you're like, you can kind of do it. But, like, if you do it on an improv, you really lock in. But then sometimes with me and voices anyways, like, when I try to lock in, it's a little trickier. Like, when I'm, like, conscious.
Yeah, no, it's not... Like, I'm not doing a bang, like, on-the-money impression.
You're doing the vibe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so it was fun. It was silly. I mean, like... You know, I was essentially calling him a sycophant. Hicks's whole thing was the artistic roll call bit, where he's saying, like, you know, he's selling Doritos, doesn't need the
but
money.
But the weird thing is like, that is that, if you can criticize that, but that's all of it, right? So you're standing against this flood, right? This tsunami of mainstream entertainment, you know, saying fuck you, and no one really gives a fuck that you say that except three other fuck you people. But ultimately, you know, you're going to find yourself having to navigate that world.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, you know, even when I posted on Instagram that I was doing Kimmel, all the comments were like, well, what about Fallon? Or, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and you set yourself up for that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Like, well, so then there's a question of, like, you know, okay, these are what I think. This is, like, my actual thought. It's so easy to throw stones from the outside. But then I'm also not trying to self-sabotage. I don't want to deny myself.
Are you not?
I don't think so. I mean, like, or at least I'm wrestling that.
No, I see that. But because, like, you know, what you do at the end of the special, I'm not talking about cinematically because I don't want to spoil that for anybody, but because I think it seems that, you know, whether you intended to or not, because you directed this thing, and we should get into some background with that stuff, but... The thing that, like, stuck with me, like, the one joke that I was, you know, concerned about, doesn't matter really, but I ended up, you know, Googling the punchline, and then it took me to, you know, this, you know, took me to Zizek, which I imagine you've read him or seen him.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm familiar with Zizek.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing you're talking about, and we could talk about it if you want,
the Titanic bit?
Yeah.
Well, it's so weird to me. Like, I thought, like, there's a couple bits in there I thought, like, did you rush this hour? Like, were you pulling back from, like, because I know you did an hour recently, right? Not too long ago.
2018.
Oh, okay. So, wow.
Because I mean, COVID kind of, you know, I took basically a year off and, you know.
Yeah. I just was like, you know, it's like, all right, we're going to do a Titanic joke. But yeah, it was only because, like, I liked the joke, but it was something that sounded, you know, familiar. So I went on this little rabbit hole.
Yeah. I think the line you're talking about is the iceberg is a hero.
Yeah, yeah.
And the article that you sent, I just got it. It was like, hey, Mark might want to talk about this. And so I was looking. I was like, oh, interesting. Someone has the same take. And then it took me a second to realize that like, maybe there was a, you know, I don't know if it was like a shady accusatory kind of thing.
No, but
so it got me a little defensive because I was like, you know, I know you're not shy on that front. And I didn't want to enter into... you know, a trial.
Well, that's what I thought, you know, when he came in. I'm like, we don't really need to get into it. And I've had that experience where, you know, whatever you fill your head with, you know, it's always exciting when, you know, somebody who's a great thinker, you know, you have the same thought. It's always exciting.
Sure.
You know, and like, there's a lot of things out there in the ether, and that thing is not a tremendous, like, it's not that, you know, like, I could see how somebody
else
can.
It's not an impossible thing to think. I mean, especially the initial, I mean, the specifics are mine, but the underlying premise of, like, this relationship wouldn't have worked.
Doomed. Yeah.
Like, you don't need to know Hegel.
Yeah, that's
get that.
You know, I don't need to know Hegel for anything.
It's just one. Yeah, I have never tried.
Yeah, I can't do him. I've tried, but I can't. There's most of the heavy hitter philosophers are just too dense for me. There's a whole language to it that I don't understand.
Right. I think you have to, like, go to school for that and
learn
language, and then have Noam Chomsky call you an idiot because he's like, it's made up.
Right. Yeah. Well, Noam Chomsky
is made up. He's like, they want to sound like scientists, but they're not.
No, it's all
so
a game.
It's like, all right.
It's like philosophy.
This is the left. This is the left.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Philosophy, psychology, theology, metaphysics. It's all sort of like an attempt at understanding.
Yeah.
Science and math are different.
No, but I think there's an interesting thing to say about that, especially when you're coming, you know, doing comedy from a position of sharing point of view and sharing perspective and insight and not just making an observation of what's in front of you, but actually doing some rumination and some thinking about what's going on. There's going to be overlap.
Sure.
You know, and I would say I put out 4 hours of material total. You know, I have
that's good
through albums and specials. But I'm just saying, like, and on my second one, there was one line that I did that bothers me to this day because it has that kind of overlap with a Stanhope line.
Yeah,
and it's like I don't need it. I didn't see it and say it.
Yeah.
I said it, and later was like, oh, that's similar. Try to change it. Try to manipulate it. Couldn't do it. Recorded it, and that's just what it is.
And no one called you on it.
No, I mean people have. I mean, like, you know, you get a YouTube comment here or there, but I think I've come to terms with that. I'm like, you know what? Like, if it's,
it took me years to come to terms with something like that.
If you're putting out 4 hours of stuff and there's two lines we're talking about throughout the entirety of the whole thing, that's like similar to a person that you look up to or that you have ingested. Okay,
right.
That to me scans still.
Yeah, you have to let it go. But see, that's what I was talking about when, you know, in terms of my reaction to you, is that there's only a handful of dudes that we know that you're not going to compare yourself against Brian Regan.
Right.
Right. So, like, the dudes that you're going to be worried about, there's three of them.
Well, apparently one of them is a Slovenian philosopher.
Yes. Well, that's true. He's
How
funny.
Far comedy has come.
No, you should be flattered. Like, that I was on the verge of accusing you of stealing from Zizek.
I mean, it's just like that just makes me laugh as a concept. It's
yes.
Like, it's like, how can you take something from someone who's not making jokes?
Well, you can.
Perspective, sure. Sure, of course.
No, that was a premise. It's a premise. And what I'm willing to indulge is that, yeah, it's not that big of a stretch of a premise.
Right.
Yeah, I get it.
And I don't think I would. The irony of that, I mean, I had a tag to that bit about how, you know, Revolutionary Road is essentially the sequel of what would have come out of that relationship. And I had seen that on a blog. And so I was like,
oh, really?
Man,
So you let it go.
Yeah. So I didn't do it. So that's just how I am. I'm not looking to score anything.
I know. And if you're a smart guy and you're trying to figure yourself out and you're trying to figure the world out and you're trying to build your point of view and you want to read smart people, you're going to fill your head with stuff. And that's just the way it goes. And a lot of that stuff influences the way you think. I know that there are drive shafts that have been very useful to me over time that weren't necessarily mine, but eventually you build your own and it evolves.
Yeah, exactly. I'm willing to concede all of that.
Sure.
I don't think that is any kind of detriment to anything.
No.
It's just kind of the function of
art,
the modality.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So, but you are from Chicago?
Mm-hmm. Suburbs, yeah.
Which suburb?
A suburb called Deerfield.
Deerfield?
You know it?
Why is that the Jewish part?
There's a few Jewish parts.
Highland Park, or is there?
Highland Park is Jewish. Yeah. Lake Forest, not so Jewish.
Yeah.
Buffalo Grove, pretty Jewish. It was that area. We went, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I have some close friends or like family friends there, but you grew up, it's just you and your brother?
A younger brother and then our two parents, and they split when I was 12. My brother was 9.
Oh, really?
And but they both live, in the area.
Yeah?
And they don't talk to each other.
Do you talk to both of them?
No. Not currently. I don't know.
Either of them?
Here's the thing. I really want to go here, but I don't know how comfortable I am putting this on blast. But
well, how about like if we just leave it around the stuff that you discuss publicly?
Okay.
So, but what did your father do when you were growing up?
He's an attorney.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Was that like and your mom does what?
She was an art teacher, but she's retired.
Was she ever an artist?
She paints.
Yeah, my mom was a painter, too.
She paints. She got back into it. She was married to a guy who nobody liked. And, like, literally nobody. Like, he had no...
Not just you.
No, well, certainly not me, but, like, none of my mom's family. Like, there was not a single fan.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was kind of like
how old were you when they got married?
Yeah, yeah.
How old were you when they got married, that guy?
20. I was 20.
So you're a grown person, and you had to deal with it.
Oh, yeah. I know. Yeah, I was grown enough for him to scream at me.
The second guy. Not even the original guy.
No, he, I don't mind. I won't say his name, but I don't mind.
They're still together?
No. They got divorced when I was... my parents are both twice divorced. Like, they were each other's first.
They keep trying, huh?
Yeah. Well, yes. And so... my point was that when my mom was married to this guy, it was kind of like this... Stockholm kind of thing. All of her, the sign to me that it was bad, other than the fact that he was this guy, was she wasn't painting anymore. And she wasn't doing anything for herself. She wasn't doing anything creative. And she's a very creative, free thinking person.
Yeah.
Or free flowing person, I should say. And, I eventually was like, hey, this is not good. You don't do anything. I got you this canvas to paint on 2 years ago for your birthday. You haven't touched it. It's in your fucking attic.
Yeah.
Like,
that's sad.
This is coming from, she was so moved by the conversation that, she's essentially initiated the kind of proceedings, and they end up getting divorced. And so
you woke her up.
Well, yeah. The irony is the first divorce, it's not your fault. The second one. Oh, it is.
if you make it a case.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, this one, I'm on team do this. I'm not trying to keep this together. This is a different thing.
Yeah. So you talk about this hearing thing that seems to be the crux of the neglect.
Yeah, well, it's funny how painfully obvious and also how long it took me to discover that. It is. Like, it's always been something I've known about. It's been conscious.
You were born with it?
I think 3 years old.
What happened?
I think they don't know. Hearing ear infections and shit.
Huh.
Maybe. But it's like hair follicle. Like, the follicles are dead. It's not like they don't, no one's ever given me a clear answer on it. I've always been like, what happened? Like, it could be a million things.
Yeah, I have ear problems now and they can't figure it out.
Like tinnitus or whatever?
I don't know. Like, the pressure problems. It feels like eustachian tube stuff, like in my left ear, like it gets like I feel a rumble when I hear things. Like it sounds like a broken speaker, but pressure's fine, the drum is fine.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I was really it's the only reason I had you over.
Yeah, well, I could leave.
I had MRI yesterday.
Yeah, they'll probably tell you more than I can. But I was...
No, I want you to look.
When I was... do you have one of those things? Do you have the...
My dad did.
The lens thing?
He was a doctor.
One of those things.
A little light.
Yeah, the light, but it's like that kind of little conic shape thing. That
they
really...
There's all kinds of attachments to those, to the lights.
I've seen them all.
Yeah. All right, go ahead.
No, 3 years old. And I was prescribed hearing aids, I think, then or maybe when I was five. And the way my parents tell the story is like, I just didn't want them. And I've kind of always accepted that narrative as just what it was. Like, oh, yeah, I was stubborn. Yeah, well, exactly. And but it's kind of what you're talking about. You don't internalize that kind of independence until you actually, establish it later in life. And then you kind of have to like retroactively go back and apply that same like self-identity that you come to in your 30s or 40s, whatever it is. And then you have to essentially, transcribe it to your past, and it's a very jarring thing.
Yeah,
I do think that like one of the hardest things about coming to terms with yourself and with who you are and what you've gone through is that you have to acknowledge the fact that this kid that you were, it's not a different kid, it's you, experienced it that way.
Right.
Because when you're going through it, there's all sorts of, you're cultivating all sorts of defenses to prevent yourself from acknowledging that this is happening.
Yeah.
Right? Whether it's anger or dissociation or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then if you are trying to, reconnect with yourself, you have to go back and look at yourself as that kid and say, no, he was going through that. It wasn't this other thing that he had imagined. It was this. It was neglect. It was isolation. It was pain. It was agony.
So it's horrible. Like to really, it's almost like this weird, narcissistic empathy experiment, where I have to place myself into myself as a 5 year old or a 6 year old, in these points of trauma and experience that feeling of weird, of horrible pain and lack of control.
I don't know if it's narcissism.
No, it's not
narcissistic.
I mean, self-involved, maybe self-centered.
Well, there's like a judgment attached to that, and I'm not trying to be all new agey about it, but it's like self-involved, meaning like in a literal sense.
Okay,
yes.
Well, how about it's an experiment in time travel. Okay, you don't have to label it self-centered or self-aware, but it is an attempt to excavate your heart from the younger part of yourself that felt it being broken.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, and you know, I don't think like connecting with yourself or exploring yourself is inherently, you know, a self-involved or selfish.
No, I don't mind it. I spend it. And I only meant narcissism in that there you're literally looking at a reflection of yourself based on what you think you were going through at that time. So I wasn't using it in a clinical sense. I think I was using it just in this, like the exercise
the Greek
of
sense,
it.
Like the narcissist.
Almost, yeah. You know, only that it's only a sad kid that's in the mirror.
Looking back in the pond or whatever it is. Yeah. No, right. It was very easy for me to categorize my childhood as sad, but it was a much more difficult phenomenon to like feel that.
Yeah,
and
let
myself know what that sadness feels like.
How'd you do it?
A lot of therapy.
Really?
I was seeing a therapist regularly, and then we started going twice a week.
How old are you? When you went to a therapist?
Oh, I mean, I started going when I was 13.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but then it was kind of on and off.
Right after the divorce?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, you need therapy.
That's your problem.
Right, they're like, you need therapy. I was like, you need therapy.
I
would say only recently have I fully like committed to it, like the last few years, where I was going regularly and then it up to twice a week, and then my therapist recommended doing it four times a week. You know, that's essentially psychoanalysis.
Old school.
Yeah, it's just, well, so it's interesting, and something happened over COVID that was kind of a revelation. Because of the hearing thing, I can't do the whole sit on the couch while the therapist is behind you, because if I can't see you, I mean, this is different. I have headphones on right now, but if I can't see your mouth, it's very hard for me to hear what you're saying. We experienced this earlier. You were trying to tell me which way to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know. I couldn't hear what you were saying. So she's behind me. I can't hear what she's saying, or I'm stressed out.
You don't have hearing aids now?
I do.
Oh.
I do, but it's not okay. Perfect.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. They're in there deep?
Yeah. They're.
The new kind?
Have you done any research on this?
No.
Yeah. No, they're newish, and they came out in like 2008, and I was a pretty early adopter. I was by far the youngest person to, like, I would go to the, you know, the audiologist. It's me and people who like can't hold their heads up. It's,
right.
You know, like it's.
Was it like a miracle?
I had played with a different kind before, so it was maybe like a more of a gradual slope up. But yeah, I mean, I couldn't get by. I couldn't do this. I couldn't do anything without him. I couldn't have lunch with friends.
Yeah.
It's not even like I could do it. It would just be so fucking stressful, and I would be working so hard.
But you never learned, you know, you never had to sign or do any of that.
No, because I kind of straddled worlds. Like, I faked it. Dude, I didn't wear hearing aids till I was in my early 20s, like 2021.
Really?
Yeah.
And so you faked it. For whose sake? Your parents?
I don't
just to get
know.
By.
That's the thing. I just did it. Like, it was just, I didn't want to acknowledge whatever that meant. And I was never, you know, forced or encouraged encouraged that, you know, they suggested it. They were willing to do it, but it was really up to me, which I don't think it should have been. But it was never, there was no programs. I was never like, you know, linked with any sort of social workers who like specialized in this stuff, or speech pathologists, or anything like that. I think part of the problem was, and this isn't even me like patting myself on the back, I think like I excelled in pretty much everything that I did, just on a like, you know, material level.
Yeah.
Like my grades were always A's, and I was like, you know, I played baseball and I was good at baseball. And so I think if I was getting like F's, they'd be like, what the fuck is going on? And then we have to diagnose something.
But you sort of like, you double engaged, you know, to compensate probably in a way.
It's so funny to now think about what I was doing, because at the time it was second nature. I didn't think this was anything.
Yeah.
This is just what, you know, I would have to sit.
But you wanted to be at least normal. You knew that.
I did. I did want to be. Yeah. That is a very hard thing to say and think, but it's absolutely true. Like, it's hard in the sense that it's emotional.
Yeah.
I very badly did. I didn't want to be different, and I didn't want to be a burden.
Right.
You know, like, even saying like, you know, what, like asking people to repeat what they said, I would feel like this, and maybe it was all in my mind, there was this like resentment toward me for making them repeat what they just fucking said.
Right.
And so I didn't want to do that. And so I would fake it. I would act as if I heard it. I would.
So were you were constantly projecting what you thought people were thinking about you? Like, you know, like I'm annoying if I say what. And I,
Yeah. And they would, because I never talked about it until maybe I was 18.
Wow, that's a long time.
So people didn't know.
Yeah.
So like if I said what, they thought I was either stupid or not paying attention. Yeah. So they would get annoyed on those grounds.
Yeah.
But like, you know, nobody would, my friends aren't like true assholes. Like they, if they knew, and certainly as we've gotten older, they look out for me in that way, you know, which I'm appreciative of. But yeah, it was, that is a major source of all this shit. Like that, whatever the level of disconnect and the fighting with myself and just even like this kind of unfortunate irony of like craving solitude and also hating it. Right, because like I wanted to get away from people because they stressed me out. Because I had to be working 10 times as hard to try to ascertain what was going on, and so I just wanted to get the fuck away. I felt relaxed when I was at home alone, watching TV, playing video games, you know, looking at porn on the internet, whatever the fuck it was.
Yeah,
like, or even in my room, just like talking to myself.
Yeah,
because you know, I think I might have said this on stage before, but you never mishear yourself.
Yeah,
you know, you're always, your inner monologue says something. You're never like, wait,
yeah, the problem is when you have two going.
believe me, I you can get a bunch of voices up there, but I crave that kind of solitude just to give me some relief from the stress that came with being with people. But then at the same time, solitude is incredibly hard for me because like I also crave connection.
Well, that's like, it's a perfect recipe for stand up.
Well,
because you can hear yourself. You decide what's being said. People hear you.
Right.
And you have complete control over that thing.
Right. Right. Which I think is why I struggle with the sort of unilateral nature of it, because I'm looking for connection here. And this is the closest I've come to it. But I think I realize that it isn't what I need it to be.
Sure. But I think that what happens and what will happen as you get older is that you might get some more joy out of it if you figure out how to engage that part of your vulnerability.
Yeah, and that certainly is, you know, what I hope to do. And then also, but also offstage, and find a way to supplement, not supplement, but get the connection
right
in life.
Have a life.
And then the stand-up can be more of a... you know, an extracurricular exploration of this thing rather than like a need.
Right, a need, and also
share with people as opposed to try to get something from it.
Or not limited to, you know, the range of your emotional perception at this time. Like if you get out more and you build a life where your life becomes bigger, or you let go of some things, then you might bring that on stage and it broadens your perspective.
A million percent. A million percent. I think that the posture of you know, look at me versus I want to share this with you.
Yes.
It can be potentially a game changer. And that's like, you know, something that
you're waiting for it.
I'm challenging myself to do it. No, like that's, you know.
Yeah.
Because obviously I don't think anyone wants to watch an artist, no matter what kind, musician, filmmaker, comic, just repeat themselves and impersonate themselves.
Uh-huh.
I think like if there's no growth happening,
right?
You know, then the fuck is the point? I mean, I guess I have to acknowledge that like I feel very lucky that I wasn't stressing during that time in terms of.
Oh yeah, but money, you were starting to say something you didn't finish about therapy and COVID.
Oh yeah, the happy accident of that was because I can't do the, you know, psychoanalysis, that kind of classic couch therapist behind the couch.
Sure.
The purpose of that is so you can kind of free associate stream of consciousness. You're not burdened by the visual stimulation of the therapist's reactions.
Yes,
you're looking into the ether, closing your eyes, whatever you're doing. I can't do that, but over the phone, throw on headphones, all of a sudden I can. And so it was this weird thing where I started doing therapy. No Zoom. It was just over the phone.
Right.
Put on the headphones, lie down on my own couch, close my eyes, and it was like, oh, this is a completely different thing than talking to someone who's in a chair.
Yeah.
And I felt like so liberated by it. And then the repetition, it's four times a week. So you're doing it every Monday through Thursday. So basically every day. So like you like do it and you're like, oh, Jesus. And you don't have any time to recover. It's like a back-to-back in the NBA, whatever. It's like, all right, we're getting the next morning. You wake up, I gotta fucking do that again. And
right.
So you're like already reeling from the thing before, and that's the purpose. Is it keeps you open, and you know you're not able to zip it back up, and then have to undo it for 45 minutes once a week and zip it back up. So it's exhausting. Like it's truly exhausting. And so I found through that I was able to tap into some things that felt new.
Oh, good. That's good.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so you do well in school and then where you go to college?
I went to University of Illinois for a couple of years. I was an engineering major.
Really?
I was a good math and science.
Yeah?
Yeah. And it's funny, I went back home years ago and I was digging through old stuff. And I was deciding, should I stay in school? I kind of like comedy. Should I write? Blah, blah, blah. And I was looking for some kind of sign and I found some old certificate in my, my drawer from when I was a kid. And I found this certificate, some test I took in high school, the standardized, not the SAT, but something like that, some assessment thing. And it was you excelled in math, science, and writing. And I'm this is not fucking helpful.
Huh. Well, one of them was.
Am I better at one? Should I follow something? It's you could do either of these if you want.
And so you didn't finish?
No, I dropped out. A couple of times. I had a rough go in college. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. I took all these AP classes in high school, and so I was a sophomore when I went to college.
Yeah.
Academically, and I didn't know how to be a person.
Yeah.
I couldn't hear anybody. I was so lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I didn't go to class. I played Madden, got high. I discovered weed, and that was kind of it. But then slowly I built myself up, did better in school. By my first semester junior year, I got all A's, and then I dropped out.
Yeah?
And I went back, dropped out again, then I moved back home, was taking classes at-
To Deerfield?
I was working at the Cheesecake Factory, doing open mics, and I was doing, I was in school up there at University of Illinois, Chicago.
Yeah.
And then it was too much. I was these three things I can't do. I can't work.
Cheesecake?
I can't do cheesecake.
Comedy,
and class. Yeah, the three C's. And so I was I got to pick two. And so I was I can't not work. So I dropped out of school. That was the last time. And then just started doing open mics and moved to the city. And then that was kind of how, then I started wearing hearing aids. And that was kind of when this part of my life started.
And so when was that?
2008.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, who do you see as your generation of guys? Because I've never seen you before. I don't know why. But you ended up in New York.
No, we've seen each other. I did a guest spot for you, I want to say 10 years ago, at Bloomington, Indiana.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I Jared. Like that room.
Yeah, it's a good room. Jared wanted you to see me. And I think I remember what he said you said. I think you watched me.
Yeah.
And then you went back into the green room. You're like, somebody's listening. Or something like that. And then I think I saw you in Chicago.
You saw me at the main stage? Those were always pretty fun shows.
Main stage, yeah. Somebody asked you a question that I thought was awesome. This woman shouted out, she's like, when are you going to enjoy your success?
Yeah.
That's a hard heckle. There's no quip for that. There's no
I like that you remember the heckle, but not my response.
I think you kind of just were like, I'm trying. I am. Yeah, I don't think. But I'm saying you don't think you had a haymaker for
that. No, of course not. I don't have a haymaker for anything.
You got them in there. They're in there.
No, yeah, I guess so. But it usually depends on the moment. I can't think of I don't have a list of things that I know use as retorts.
I hate crowd work so much.
Do you?
I hate it.
Hmm.
I absolutely hate it.
I don't like it because if you really, for someone like me, because I do like to communicate, and I can get, and over the years I've gotten pretty open, so there are moments where I'm like, sure, get me real. Let's get off of this. What do you want to do? I'll engage. Well, let's do it. But the problem with it is that tone, conversational me, which is funny, going back into the act.
Yeah, right.
Then, you're kind of fighting with yourself.
Yeah.
If you have real good crowd work, you can't go back.
Well, it's just a different thing. It's a joke where everyone is living the premise. And then for you to pull some other thing, so I was thinking about this,
exactly,
we were just living in the premise. Well, you were just adding the punchline.
Well, what I do when I do it is I go okay, can we go back to the act? Can we just go back
thing? Yeah, can I put the needle back on the record?
I have the prepared stuff.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, it's just a different vibe.
I don't mind it though.
I just feel like the things that can excite a crowd in crowd work are often
dumb.
Yeah, well, it's just doesn't take a lot.
Yeah.
It's a specific thing. And
you're so excited that you're in the moment.
Yeah, you know what you can say.
Yeah.
And I often will just not say it. And I'm like, this, sure. I know, you know, because I've done it when I was middling or whatever, like when I was like coming up, and you just got to get, you got to survive in a way. Like, oh, yeah, they would laugh at the dumbest fucking thing because it happened here.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they're dumb for laughing.
I think they're witnessing something that's never going to happen again.
Or just, you know, it's exciting because they don't know. They know that you don't know.
And then you watch crowd work comics, like there's a couple around just do the same, you know, at least 80% of the same.
Yeah, crowd work is fake.
Yeah, a lot of it.
Like this, it's like we're already pretending this is off the cuff and we know it's not. And you're doing like an art form on top of that that is claiming to be like, no, really off the cuff, that's also fake.
Right. I like doing, like, just I just like talking sometimes. Because, like, so many of my fans are used to so many different facets of me that I have the freedom to do it. Like, you know, if they really engage me with a question, like, you know, like, how are your cats? Or did you get that thing looked at on your head?
Well, I would imagine, I mean, it has to be the case that every single person coming to see you has listened to you talk more than they've listened to you do stand-up.
Maybe. Like, I get, like, there's all different places they come from now. You know, from, like, the Globe. Some people, like, don't know anything about the podcast.
Oh, sure.
It's weird. You know, like, I never know when someone goes, I really like your show. I'm like, well, which one?
Yeah,
what?
Right.
You can't be that guy.
You're the guy in the classic joke. The guy at the comic at the bar.
Early
show, late show.
Yeah, well, how do you know that joke? I mean, what's your version?
Oh, like comic, you know, does shows on, you know, finishes Friday or Saturday, goes to the bar next door. This girl's like, oh, you're so hitting on him. You're so funny.
Yeah. Which show?
You see earlier this show.
That's it. Yeah.
This is the slightly more successful version of that. It's like, sure. I like your show, the TV or the radio. The special.
Well, you always want to take it away from them. You know, it's sort of like, oh, that. Yeah, I don't know.
Right. It's like, oh, no, you shouldn't like that idiot.
You got to listen to the other thing.
This episode of this thing.
Yeah, I've become very gracious as years have gone by, you know.
Yeah, don't take I feel like.
Yeah, don't take their experience away from them.
I feel like you've done well.
Yeah, I've done all right. I have.
Like, what do you want?
I'm happy.
The garden? Get out of here.
The garden?
Yeah, like, what do you...
No, I can't do that.
Yeah, I'm saying, what do you want?
I have no idea what to do with that. I'm fine. I really am. You know, the happiness element is, you know, what you... you didn't really address... Like, I've addressed happiness. You addressed love. You go do a deeper source in the special. what is love, really? Yeah, I'm okay, man. You know, I'm okay. There's a lot of things that, you know, seek resolution. You know, I don't know, you know, where I stand in moving forward with relationships. And I don't, but I have made conscious efforts now to do things that I've always wanted to do without fear, you know.
That's good.
And, you know, try to enjoy things and at least acknowledge, you know, what I do enjoy and allow it as opposed to just be compulsive about behavior, you know.
Well, do you find that compulsion influences the relationship outcomes as well? Like the compulsion doesn't have to be a behavior. It can be a mode of thought.
Sure.
Like it could be like, it's really comfortable sometimes for me to attach myself to a more, a fantasy or a type of dynamic that's exciting, but obviously has no legs and obviously is doomed and it's obviously only going to end in nothing or hurt me or hurt them or, you know, it's like it but there's something that I compulsively will follow about that because it just speaks to me so clearly.
But you start to know better.
I think I'm getting that point, but as someone, again, you're
I just don't know like how to that kind of stuff, like, you know, how many times can you make that mistake? Like, you know, because like as you get older too, you know, more so than not, you're not going to walk away from it, you know. Well, sometimes if you're lucky and the other person's compulsive too, and they're kind of like, oh, what was that? I don't know, but we're good. Yeah, and you can walk away kind of free. But, you know, depending on someone else's expectation, you know, someone's going to get hurt and it's horrible. Yeah, how many times can you heartbreak? How many times can you hurt people? How many times can you hurt
yourself? I don't want to do it. I don't want to break up ever again. Like, I don't want to do it. Because it's never, I've never broken up with someone, and it's been like one of those, like, yeah, you know, we see each other around, and we just fell out of love.
It's like, you cannot be anywhere I am.
Yeah, no, I don't want that. And I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just saying, like, I don't want to get involved in something that has that type of tenor where those are the stakes.
I know, but we're not normal. I'm not saying we're broken, But emotionally, when you talk about wiring, you know, if your heart is looking for what you come from, then you're going to be in a trouble. You know,
well, that's the compulsion, is to give into that, or to say, to maybe take a step back from that and
sure.
go, wait a minute, okay. I have this like idea of dating in New York, for example,
okay.
where it's the friends of mine that are single,
yeah,
and then I have like the family friends, you know, the people they're married,
sure.
they're having their second kids,
yeah,
that's my world: showbiz, single, and like regular people,
yeah,
doing the whole thing.
Nice, good for you to have friends.
Yeah, you know, I do okay. A little side note: the friends of mine that have kids, seeing them raise children has been instrumental in me realizing the deprivation I experienced as a child. Because I'm like, oh, I've never seen this
right.
loving. I mean, it's different variations of it. They're not all
sure.
the same, but like, they're all very loving. Their relationships are, for the most part, very good. Like, they belong together. They
yeah.
care about each other. They respect each other.
Yeah.
There's a lot of independence in the sense that like, they don't need anything from their children. They're able to facilitate. They're able to be there.
They're able to facilitate their children's, coming into themselves,
yeah.
without intruding or neglecting,
right.
and or feeling like they're fucking up somehow.
Yeah, or setting up a dynamic where the kid is meant to like make the parent feel better about themselves.
Sure,
as a
the
parent.
Appendage. Yeah,
yeah.
You're just your parents' appendage. The narcissistic parents just make you an arm.
Yeah, they can't need you to make them feel good about themselves.
Right.
So I see that, and it's been pretty instrumental in me, you know, realizing things about myself. The special is dedicated to, at the very last card is dedicated to, you know, it's 10 different names, and those are all my friends' kids. Those are all my friends and one of my cousins'
that's nice.
Kids.
Yeah,
yeah. Because I feel like they have truly shown me, like, you know, what it could have been, or what it should be, or so
sure.
on and so forth. That was a slight side note, but the single show busy art scene friends
uh-huh.
in New York.
Yeah.
There is this kind of thing where we're all like fucked up in a similar way, especially, you know, actors, comics, musicians,
yeah.
directors, performers, people that need to be showcased in some kind of way. I do think it comes from, you know, like, or at least it goes hand in hand with this idea of like longing for someone to reach back or something like that, or chasing the thing that is unavailable, so on and so forth. And so I have this image in my mind of dating in New York, which is like everyone is chasing after someone who's chasing after someone else, who's chasing after someone else. And it just goes on like that, this kind of recursive loop of people reaching out for someone who doesn't give them the time of day. And I was like, what if we all just turned around and there's this person who's reaching for you, who's available, who doesn't make it hard. There's no fucking games. There's no, oh, are they going to text back? They just do it.
Yeah,
and it's and they like you, but on merit, not just because you're anyone, but because they get to know you. And it's like, that feels so fundamentally different from what I'm used to.
Sure, but that's it's romantic, and I like it, you know. And but like,
where's the flaw?
There's no flaw in wanting that, but like, my experience has been, you have to then be comfortable with that other thing not being satisfied, and what that's going to do.
What does that do?
Yeah.
I do wonder. I'm like, can we have this, but then also let me, just give me like 3 days out of the month. Don't ask questions. They're not going to be infidelity necessarily. It's just going to be something.
But here's the thing. You know, once you really wrap your brain around honest self-acceptance, you know, and get your needs in order, you can ask for whatever the fuck you want.
Right. Yeah. It's a new world.
And maybe you can get it. But like, you know, if you're constantly second-guessing yourself or have that shitty voice in your head, you're going to make all these assumptions, you know, moral judgments, or, you know, judgments about yourself in relation to them or what they're thinking, that there's no way you can be like, well, look, I'm going to fuck someone else once a month. What are you going to do? You know, like, after a certain age, if you got no kids and no real responsibilities, you don't owe anybody anything. What does it hurt to be that honest to see if you can do it?
Right, but is there something alienating about that?
Of course, well,
yeah.
Maybe. Yeah, but like, but wait, but the thing is, it may be alienating, but maybe not. I mean, you know, like if you're really talking about like sustaining something with somebody that, you know, who the fuck knows?
Right.
I just know
right.
that I'm so fucking insecure on some level that I'm just going to do their thinking for them and I'm going to do their judging of me for them and I'm going to judge myself for them. Half the conversations I'm in with them, I'm making up. You know, like, you know, I'll jump right. into the middle
right.
of something that I'm having in my head with them and they're like, what are you talking about? Like, oh yeah, right.
Yeah, like, you don't fucking know. What you did. You know what you did. That's exactly what you were thinking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. yeah. So once you get that out of the way, you know, and really own yourself and say, look, this is the way I am. Once you like really are, you can be honest with yourself and self-accepting, and you have nothing to lose by being honest with the people that you want to be involved with, then there's a certain freedom in that. But it takes a lot to get there, right?
Yeah, but I also want to make sure that my honesty isn't just
weaponized.
You know, yeah, well, exactly. It's not just me like repurposing, impulse as honesty. Because like this goes back.
What do you mean impulse?
Well, just
defensiveness.
Like, no, but like you know, like yeah, I want to fuck someone or something. Like that's an impulse. And so to be like, well, that's just me. I got to do it. Like.
Well, maybe that was a bad example.
But fine, or whatever it is. Or
right, oh, here's a good example.
Or I'm going to shut down.
Well, here's a good example. Like, you know, like I've been kind of, you know, I've had a rough go of it. You know, my girlfriend died, you know, a year and a half ago or whatever. And, you know, it was the beginning of something great and it didn't happen because she got sick and died. And I never really had any very good relationships, you know, in my whole life. Mm-hmm. They two marriages, none of them, they didn't work out. Now, you know, and I was a monster in a lot of them for probably the same reasons you've been a monster. Insecure, yelling, whatever, jealous, whatever.
I don't know if I've been a monster.
Oh, I've been a monster.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to project.
No, it's okay.
But,
comes to the territory.
Sure. But, you know, like now, like I know where I'm at. And I've seen something horrible. And I felt, you know, like I didn't ever want to break up with anybody again either. And then somebody dies or whatever.
That's horrible.
It's horrible. So, but like now in this situation I'm in now where it's sort of like, I don't know what I've got in me and I don't know if I can handle this or that. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, this is where I'm at. You know, I am, you know, I'm heartbroken. I'm very, you know, wary of moving forward with something profoundly intimate, but I want to hang out.
Right.
But I don't want you to sweep over, ever.
Right.
Is that okay with you?
Yeah, it's the, it reminds me of a Jason Isbell line.
Oh, yeah?
Heart like a rebuilt part. I don't know how much it's got left.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, if I'm trying to honor myself, I mean, you know, outside of the, like, well, I'm going to fuck somebody, and you know, like, you know, not the testing thing, but just sort of, this is what I can handle, and, you know, if you're okay with it, we can move forward. If you're not, I can't do it.
Well, you could also need just time to heal.
Yeah,
of course.
That's
a pretty traumatic thing.
Oh, it's horrible. Yeah. But you still want to, you know, have company and do stuff.
Sure. And, yeah. and on that level, it's like this. Well, that's teaching me that. Stating what you're capable of is honesty. It's
right.
Like, this is what I have room for.
Right.
And, you know, obviously, just because you're not ready, just because one isn't ready for
sure.
the thing,
yeah.
capital T, doesn't mean that they can't interact with people.
But I think that's a good place to start with what we're talking about, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between capacity, emotional capacity at
yeah.
this time or whatever,
yeah, yeah, right.
and like unpleasant kind of just like instincts that you might have just to you know, like for example, if your instinct is to diminish them or in an argument, like that can't be honesty.
No, it's not. And like,
that's what I meant by repurposing impulse
sure.
as honesty.
But one thing I know about being annihilated, you know, emotionally and mentally with reality is that like a lot of that acting out bullshit, the stuff that you do instinctively to avoid whatever, you know, yourself.
Right.
Feelings,
exactly.
You know, that stuff starts to tire out.
I agree. And this kind of dovetails, in my opinion, to some of the stuff you're talking about in comedy. I
yeah.
feel like a lot of impulse is being branded as honesty in comedy, where it's like...
Sure. Acting out. Anger,
yeah. And,
like,
and
where's
being
the honesty?
Petulant and being like, well, this is... Like I think there's a difference between... Like honesty doesn't mean literally saying everything you think at every time. That's not honesty to me. Because, like, that's just... Shame.
Right, because like someone once said to me at an AA meeting, it was genius because I told my, like I had shared something about telling somebody something and I thought I was really working a good program because I was being so honest. And this guy comes up to me and goes, don't use honesty as a weapon.
Right, that's what you said earlier.
Yeah,
yeah, don't weaponize it.
But that's real, man.
And how yeah, it is. It's like,
it's
I'm just
preemptive.
Being honest.
Yeah, man,
it's
and
like,
it's preemptive.
That isn't honest. Like, and I think that's kind of what I start to talk about as well,
yeah.
or I start to think about,
yeah.
which is like this idea of honesty as saying what you think versus addressing how you feel.
Mm.
Those are two different kinds of honesty, and I think one is much harder and truer.
Right, and the other one is actually stifling that.
Yeah, like if you said something to me,
yeah,
it made me upset, it made me defensive, and I said something about you that was technically true, it's like, well, I'm just being honest, but what would be, I think, more honest is like, I'm feeling hurt by what you just said.
Sure.
And maybe that's not as cool, and maybe that's, you know, but that is the honest
but
statement.
But that's what's interesting about doing the kind of comedy that you do or that I do, is that, you know, so much of it is, you know, that's what's under the surface of it, is that you're talking, like lately I've been having this experience where I know the tone I'm talking in and the things I'm saying, where like I'm laughing, but it's so close to crying.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, and I don't mind it, but I'm wondering like, well, should I just be, is this okay? Is this like, what does this mean? Like so much of that posturing is really about, would someone just love me? Would somebody? I defy you.
Well, the defying is the kind of, that's what's, you know, driving it away.
I know, but emotionally, you know, it's just a cry for help.
Well, so it's funny because like I used to do shows and there would be people who'd come up after me or message me or whatever and say like, you know, I want to give you a hug. Like, I want to give you a hug.
Yeah.
And I was always like, I was like, oh, they don't get it.
Yeah, no,
they don't get it.
No,
and,
they
and
see it.
They get it. Like they got it more than the people who were like laughing saying like, oh, so funny. And is this real? Like those people who are like, I want to hug you. They get it because they're picking
it.
Up the tenor that you're talking about that year.
Yeah, that's not great.
I don't know. I think
it makes me feel very vulnerable, not intentionally. Whereas I wish I could just, you know, speak to that as opposed to exude that.
But that's the vulnerable thing, is that you don't have control over it. Is it despite your efforts to control it, to dictate the terms, they're getting something that you can't control. And that is vulnerability.
No, I know that, but like, why not be in that? Why? I know, I get the leaking. I think you said that in the special, but why not, you know, not leak? Why not just be in it? Why be the vessel?
Well, but then that's just trying to control the leak.
I guess.
You know what I mean? I'm not trying to get too abstract, but like it what you're saying, the leak is inherent in the vulnerability. It's like you're going to be, in order to be vulnerable, you have to be willing to be communicating something that you might not be aware you're communicating.
No, but you're not. What you're communicating is this attempt at hiding your vulnerability. Because, you know, if somebody's,
right.
if half the audience is laughing and then three people are like, you okay?
Oh, you're saying why not just forget the facade and I'm not okay.
Yeah.
Well, but that's kind of, I mean, I do kind of, you know.
Yeah, do that at the end.
Well, but kind of, or at least point to what that would be. And I think that like, it is tough because you are trying to put on a show.
Sure.
Like you're not a lunatic.
But there's people like, that put shows, dude. There's like, there are people in our business who do it because they love the love.
Right.
And those kind of people who go up there and sing a song, do a little dance, or just embrace something, you know, beautiful and nonsensical, they're living in it. And they're very entertaining. And people leave going like, that was so fun.
Right. Yeah, but who knows what the mechanics of that
are. Okay.
You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Who knows? I don't know what makes them tick.
I don't either. They could get backstage and like, you know, jerk off into a cup and throw it against the wall and drink a half gallon of booze. I know, probably.
No, right. I've known people like that.
Yeah, me too.
Where it's just like,
You're a mess.
Liar. It's not they're a mess. It's just like, there's nowhere to put that anywhere else.
Yeah. So when, like, who are your guys that you came up with? Do I know them? Did you come up, you're the one behind Pete Holmes and Hannibal and that crew, Kamal?
Yeah, so Hannibal was there for like a year when I started.
Uh-huh.
So we overlapped for a little bit of time. Then he moved to New York. A lot of the people, Beth Stelling came up with me in Chicago.
Yeah.
She's out here, right? She's out here.
Yeah.
Cameron Esposito was there.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to think of... Yeah, who like moved out.
But what rooms did you come up in? Did you do mainstream rooms or most of those alt ones?
I helped start a room called Comedians You Should Know in Chicago, which still exists. I mean, I have... I
But wasn't there a place called like the Lodge or something?
Lincoln Lodge. I did that. I would kind of do everything, but I was never anyone's
person. But never Zanies?
Person. I did Zanies.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So then you, like, what brings you to New York? You just decide to go?
You hit a ceiling in Chicago. I mean, I came up at a time where, you know, we were starting to get a little bit of industry where Montreal would come there. They had like JFL Chicago.
Yeah.
For a couple of years, and
I think
so
I
people
did
were
that once.
People were starting to pay attention. And I think once the Lakeshore went under, which was April of 2010, the Laugh Factory bought the space, gutted it, changed everything, made it a Laugh Factory, and that kind of brought with it a little bit of a commercial viability to Chicago in both good and bad ways.
But I went in there once. I never worked there. It seemed weird.
Structurally
weird.
It's weird. It's different than the one.
I don't work at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah. What are you, a store guy?
I'm pretty much all store when I'm here.
All store all the time?
Yes.
But in terms of, like, I never felt like in Chicago I did. I had some guys that we kind of came up with, that we kind of came up together, but a lot of them are still there. And so I never felt part of a crew.
And
or
did you,
like that.
You got, you were, did you write at SNL?
Yeah, for a year.
How was that?
Not good. Does anyone ever say it was awesome?
Yeah, the ones that were treated well.
Or the ones that are still there.
Sure.
Like, no one's there for 1 year. It was like, it was sick.
No,
was,
1 year usually means it was not good.
Well, it's just, of course. It's like, I wrote for a Weekend Update. It was the year of the election, the 2016 election.
You writing for Che? And
Yeah. I got maybe 4 jokes on the entire season.
Oh. And you just sat there beating yourself up? Or
no, I kind of didn't. You know, it was weird. It's like, it wasn't like a lifelong dream of mine. I didn't even apply. I got asked to do it.
By
and so
who?
It was by Che.
Oh.
And so I didn't.
Is he a Chicago guy? No.
No, Che's not. Che's New York.
Oh, yeah.
Che grew up like Larissa.
Yeah, yeah.
Or New Jersey. I forget exactly where. Yeah. But so it wasn't like there. I didn't play any the let me stay here game.
Yeah.
You know, everyone dressed up. not to sound like, but like everyone dressed up on Saturday. We wear like a suit on show night. I'm like, I'm not wearing a suit. I'm not even on.
Yeah.
No one sees me. Yeah. I'm in the writer's room. I'm in the office.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah.
So I would wear what I'm wearing now. Like I don't dress like a schlub, but like, I'm not. So that kind of helped.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know. It was just stuff like that where I was just like, I'm not like giddy to be
so
here.
So was this, stand-up's always been the thing then?
Yeah, stand-up has always been the thing. And that's something that is on its own kind of uncommon.
So right now the push is, you'd like to have a draw?
Yeah, more so than now. It's just the freedom to do things kind of on my own.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't want to be reliant on anyone, but I don't have fantasies of fame or massive anything.
But just, like for me, like, I have, you know, I can sell some tickets now and people know me.
Yeah.
Not, you know, enough. You know, I can sell out the Vic, you know, maybe, and maybe do 2 shows. But
that's great.
Yeah, that's exactly where I need to be. And I don't like to, I like this tour I'm about to do. I'm like, I don't want to do rooms over 800 people.
Yeah, it probably starts to feel almost
it's just like you have to change your tone.
Mm-hmm.
You have to change your timing.
Yeah, I did. I did an arena once. I opened for Aziz, and it was like it felt like it was completely disconnected from people.
Sure,
you waited for like a wave of laughter
to
hit you from the back. And it was
Well, it's something you sort of like. Okay, I did that.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you start to realize, like, well, these guys can do it because they make a fucking fortune.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, you know, it's like, it doesn't, like, I'm too hard on myself to be able to be like, you know, like, I'm just going to do this weird sort of stifled, you know, version of me for this type of sort. Fortunately, that complaint is, you know, is going to fall on deaf ears. No one's offering me an arena, but I don't. But you know what I mean?
But you also like, I mean, I do think what you said something earlier, like the thing kind of chooses you. And I think that's true about the path too.
Sure.
It's like if you did an arena, it would almost be weird. Like,
well, I did a couple of those oddball shows.
Right. No, I'm saying like if it was like Mark Maron at the Madison Square Garden, what is happening in the world?
Yeah, that
now?
Mark Maron's at the.
Well, it's just like, is everyone this now? Like, is that's crazy. Like, that's frightening. If that many people.
No, it's not there yet. Everyone's just a comic now.
No, right.
Yeah.
That was my kind of like inside dystopian projection. It was like every comedy show is going to be like a comic performing for people who are there the next night or whatever.
Well, that's sort of how it starts now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like that whole world of bringer shows was not around when I was a younger.
I don't know. I don't know. But to answer your question, I mean, like, I, you know, there's just, I'm very project oriented. Like, I think in terms of projects.
Yeah, you seem to get things done.
Well, it's just like I have, you know, every hour I've put out, it's very much that structure. Like, I'm building this hour, and I think it's gotten more and more cohesive as time has gone on.
Yeah.
But, you know, do the hour, find a way to film it that I think is interesting, and record it, put it out, promote it as much as possible, move on, disappear. Like, I'm not like a personality promoter. Huh?
But do the comedy.
Go back to work. Yeah. And so, like, you know, the next project, I have an idea for something.
Oh, that's good.
And so it's a matter of just like anything that can help me facilitate the kinds of things I want to do. I don't need to be in a Marvel movie. I don't need to be, you know, like,
I like to do a little bit of the acting.
How has that been?
It's good, you know, because, like, you know, it's something, it was a dream, you know, of mine to act.
It was.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, you know, I studied a little bit of theater, but I mean, I wasn't always a comic. But, you know, when I was in college, I did a little bit of it. And I thought I could do it. So, like, you know, after I did my own show, I kind of learned how to, you know, I failed.
Was that your first kind of?
Yeah. But I knew also from knowing other comics that had shows that the first couple seasons might be a little choppy because you don't know how to be on, you know, in that world.
Yeah, you could be you, but not you on cue
in
this way.
Right, but like sort of challenging myself to do things. Acting's tedious and it's not as satisfying because you have a lot of waiting around. I mean, I don't know, maybe a play is different, but... But, you know, the last couple of times I've done it, I challenged myself and, you know, to see if I could bring something. And, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's another outlet for sure. You do music, too.
Yeah, I've been trying to do that, yeah. You know, I play, but, like, it was really a kind of a solitary thing. But now I'm going to – and now I take it out and do it in front of
people.
Yeah,
you take it on the road.
Well, I just go to Largo.
Yeah. That's the road. It's for your –
And I put a couple guys together. Yeah. It's 25 minutes out.
Yeah. It's
I got to put the thing in the car and bring it over there.
Yeah, it's the road.
So what happened with the last special – you know, that, you know, made you want to direct your own special this time?
So the last special was directed by Gerard Carmichael.
Yeah.
And he and I were working pretty closely at the time.
Yeah.
And we shot it. This is before COVID.
Yeah.
We shot it without an audience.
That sounds crazy to me.
Yeah. It was a combination. So that was Gerard's idea. And I was excited by the radical nature of it. My concern was that I didn't know how it was going to marry itself to the content. You know, like I was still thinking about how it would work as a piece. And that kind of cohesion, those discussions never really happened.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of happened. And we shot it and it got a lot of attention in press and whatnot. It became like a focal point of discussion. I mean, obviously in our little world, and it's very, people had very polarizing opinions about it. And some people thought it was, you know, a revelation. Some people were like, this is the literal worst fucking thing I've ever seen in my life. Fuck this guy. And I don't mind people feeling that way about my stuff.
Yeah.
Someone's like, fuck this guy.
Yeah.
I stand in it. I'm like, okay, I can live with that. But this did not, that special did not feel like, you know, a comedy special, you only put it on the comic. I mean, people started talking about directors of a comedy special probably 5 years ago.
I know. Well, it's like my late girlfriend directed my last two. She was a director, film director.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, we made choices around certain things because it's like everyone kind of comes upon the revelation that, like, you can't really reinvent the special that much. There is a notion to it that, you know, like what I realized and what she realized was that, you know, I'm best in an intimate situation. So she had to figure out how to shoot close and get those type of shots, well, either through a crane or actually, you know, coming on stage, you know, at certain points.
Right.
But what I knew is, like, I just don't want to see the audience. I want them to be there, but I, you know, never cut away to them.
Yeah. Well, that was a big move that happened, you know, probably reactionary to the 90s where it was like all fucking audience.
Well, they use them to
edit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, people don't see it. You see it like, oh, it's funny. I mean, those people probably aren't even laughing at
the joke. Sure.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
The irony is that taking away the audience to let the words speak for themselves. No one, literally nobody talked about what I said in the special. It was all about the fact that there was no audience, both good and bad.
Well,
I didn't like getting any type of attention, positive or negative, that didn't feel like I earned it.
But the thing about the audience is that, like, you know, they, you know, if you're sitting at home alone, the idea is, like, you know, you're not part of that audience, but the audience dictates your timing.
Sure.
So that experience is going to translate to someone watching it themselves.
Right. Right. No, it was experimental, and I dig that. Like, I'm sure. Into the experimental nature of it, and yeah. I was excited by the radical idea. It felt like two people's visions together, as opposed to like a unified marriage of
what was the album called?
Self-titled, Drew Michael.
And this new one, you directed.
Yeah. So I directed it because I didn't want to go through this experience again, where I didn't feel like positive or negative, I earned.
But the funny thing about this one,
the response.
Why is it called Red Blue? What is it?
Red Blue Green.
Why?
I mean, you know.
What, am I missing something?
I think I get cagey about like explaining what things mean. It's
what's the title?
Red Blue Green.
That's it?
Yeah.
All right.
That's the name of it. Drew Michael Red Blue Green.
Right, but why Red Blue Green?
Well, but now I have to explain. I don't want to explain. Whatever you think.
But you know why.
I mean, you have choices that you make, but...
But it's not revealed in the special. I'm not missing something.
No. Okay. It's an interpretive thing that I feel weird spelling it out.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Fine. But...
I'm not trying to be, you know, closed off.
No, whatever you want to do, bud. The, but like, the way that thing is shot, it is pretty traditional. Until it isn't. There's
yeah.
a couple of close-ups that were effective in a way that I thought there was an interesting bit of camera work. But ultimately, the joke is the reveal on some level. But it is presented as a classic comedy special.
For sure. And yeah. I mean, the thing that I wanted to do was lean into that. Like you say, there's, you know, there's only so many places you can put six cameras. Or five cameras, whatever it is, and but lean into aesthetic, lean into lighting, lean into yeah. the set design, so on and so forth, and create an atmosphere. And you know, we drew from a couple of different lookbook inspirations, and tried to create a mood that just felt obviously the drive in comedy specials lately has just been it's become more cinematic, like you know. I think it 5 years ago, someone was like, hey, what if this shit looked good? And it was like a radical act.
Uh-huh.
It was like, hey, what if we like all these cameras we have, what if we didn't just throw them on tripods and light this shit like a yeah. game show? What if we like thought about this and were conscious about it? And, yeah. you know, and people like, I mean, I don't know, but like someone like Bo Burnham was pretty instrumental in doing that. And,
yeah.
You know, both his own specials and Gerard special,
yeah, with the tiered with the balconies, the Gerard special,
yeah, the eight, but like just like it was a new way to do it.
No, I get
where it.
It
was
I get
like,
it.
Yeah, it's, you know, it was in the round, so that's not new. I mean, you know, a million people have done the yeah. round, but like just yeah. the way it was shot, it's like sure. you haven't seen anything like that before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and I think that's good. I do think it should all service the stand up though. But I mean,
yeah. Of course, you don't want the aesthetic to overtake the, yeah, well, the content.
It's tricky.
It is tricky. But my intention was definitely to lean into the tradition of it and lean into yeah. the classic nature of it because, you know, I'm, like you say, like the kind of comedy I'm doing, it's not, I'm cut from a classic cloth. It's yeah. kind of old school.
Right.
It's, you know, it's new sure. in the sense that, like, I hopefully have new things to say, but right. it's, you know, it's, you can trace it
but you're
back
doing,
to.
Yeah, you're doing stand-up.
Yeah, or, you know, yeah, you would.
Club stand-up.
You would call that stand-up.
Sure. Well, good. I enjoyed it, and it was good talking to you. You feel good?
Likewise, yeah, I think so.
Everything work out?
You know, I think we made some headway.
Good. Me too.
I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, thanks for doing it. All right, well, that's that. I hope that wasn't too awkward or weird. His special, Drew Michael, Red, Blue, Green, is now streaming on HBO Max, and now I'm going to play this... Les Paul for you. Muddy. Muddy. Boomer lives. Monkey and LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.